Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Tonight's topic is growing up on the picket line. To set the tone for tonight's show, we're going to start with a poem about parenting.
Shoulders by Naomi Shihab Nye. A man crosses the street in rain, stepping gently, looking two times north and south because his son is asleep on his shoulder. No car must splash him. No car drive too near to his shadow. This man carries the world's most sensitive cargo, but he's not marked. Nowhere does his jacket say fragile, handle with care. His ear fills up with breathing. He hears the hum of a boy's dream deep inside him. We're not going to be able to live in this world if we're not willing to do what he's doing with one another. The road will only be wide. The rain will never stop falling.
That was a poem entitled Shoulders by Palestinian-American educator and parent Naomi Shihab Nye. Tonight's show has two parts. First, we will have an intergenerational dialogue with a family talking about their legacy of community organizing, what it is like to be raised foremost with a sense of justice, and how they are helping to guide the next generation of activists. And second, we'll speak with other activists and parents about issues that include international solidarity movements, climate justice, and queer mentorships. Joining us tonight for the first part of the program are Rabbi Susan Goldberg. Susan is an artist, educator, and longtime community activist. She has been a choreographer, dancer, and a professor of dance, and has served as a consultant and designer of workshops for organizations such as the Anti-Defamation League, the American Friends Service Committee, the National Conference for Community and Justice. Susan is currently a rabbi at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple in L.A. and the rabbinic consultant to the TV show Transparent. Welcome, Susan.
Hi.
Susan's father is also with us, Art Goldberg, who is one of the founders of the free speech movement at UC Berkeley. He was dismissed from several academic institutions for his political activities, and in the 70s opened the Working People's Law Center in L.A. with its mission of providing low-fee representation to the working class community. He is passionate about representing children and is frequently appointed by the court as a minor's counsel. Art lives in Echo Park near his adult children and grandchildren. His law center continues with its political activities, encouraging the struggle for social justice by representing people arrested for civil disobedience at no cost. Welcome, Art.
Hi, I'm here.
We are also joined by Susan's mother, Ruth Beaglehall, who is the founder of Echo Parenting and Education, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting parents and teachers and other adults to break the cycle of early family violence. Ruth is originally from New Zealand and has been a preschool teacher and parent educator for over 50 years. She is the founder of two schools for children and numerous programs for parents and professionals as well. She is the author of Mama Listen, Raising a Child Without Violence, a handbook for teen parents. Welcome, Ruth.
Hello.
So I think this is the first time we have had an entire family on the show together, so we're really looking forward to this conversation. We invite you, our listeners, to join by emailing or texting us at cityvisions@kalw.org or posting a comment on kalw.org. Later in the program, we'll also open up the phone lines for your calls. Susan, let's start with you. You grew up as part of a very public family in California politics and education. Tell us about the environment and family life you grew up in.
Well, I think certainly it was a unique environment, which, of course, you don't know about when you're a kid because it's all that you know. But as I got older, I realized how unique it was. And not just for the public part of it, but really from how my parents, as well as a group of other families, really created an intentional community, if you will, within an urban setting. There were activists who had been in different places, including Berkeley, who moved into the Echo Park Silver Lake area. And my mother was newly from here from New Zealand. And, you know, one of the things that I think that one of the ideas for the show came out of the recent 50th anniversary of the free speech movement in Berkeley. And one of the things that came up is that there weren't a lot of kids and grandkids there, but, you know, we were all there with our family. And one of the comments that was made on one of the panels was wondering about, were there enough institutions of counterculture built in order to raise kids post, you know, the various movement of the 60s. And I think that that's what both of my parents set out to very intentionally do. My mother started a preschool with, you know, really pioneering the first non-biased curriculum and becoming a model program for a lot of other schools. We spoke Spanish and English and sign language, and the men were required to be caretakers, and there was also a food co-op called the Food Conspiracy. There were eating groups, there were all, you know, study groups, and of course being actively involved in the various protest movements that were happening in L.A. So it was both the public part, the protest part, but it was also very much the internal part about giving us as kids and the parents a community in which to raise us. And that community transformed over time as the feminist movement came, as different movements affected what was happening in that community, and we, you know, lived through all of it.
Art, I'd like to bring you in. One of the words that Susan used was intentional. What did you do in your in raising your own children that was maybe different than the other folks in the neighborhood?
Well, I consciously thought that I needed to live a lifestyle of activism. Many of my friends at Berkeley and other political activists over the years would send checks to political groups, but were never active in the streets or in their life, really. I would take them to almost every demonstration, because I wanted them to see that the social values of social change were extremely important, and I wanted to pass that legacy not only on to my children, but now my children happily bring their children, my grandchildren, to political events, because I totally believe that in order to live a righteous life, you have to bring about social change when there's racism and class inequality. So luckily, and I think I was lucky because I separated from their mother when the children were a very young age, so it wasn't like a, quote, ideal intact family. However, both their mother and I really stressed the fact that if they were going to grow up and be active, decent human beings, they had to fight for social change.
Ruth, let me bring you into the conversation. Were you and Art in agreement about how the values that you both wanted to pass along to your children in terms of activism?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I had come from this country, from New Zealand, and fallen into this country at the time of the women's movement, the, you know, anti-war movement, the end of the civil rights movement at that time. I had known none of this in New Zealand. And when I came, you know, I found here were voices talking what was internally in my internal conversation that I'd never had a chance to express. And my journey was to sort of really profoundly question what happens to children, you know, what is happening to children. Why do we have such terrible outcomes for children in our society, you know, even to this day? One out of every three little girls is sexually abused before she's 18. And I think this is outrageous, and this is a political question. So that began a journey with other women and with men like Art, feminist men who were really connected with the issues that we were questioning, where we really began to profoundly question how children were being raised and how we could, in our own family, raise children who would grow up to have a political consciousness about things. I think we overstepped the mark at times with our children. I think we took them into situations.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Well, actually, Susie should give you an example. I've been interested to sort of watch the hesitancy of our children and the questioning about where they take children and where they don't, and
yeah,
I don't think
yeah.
we did enough of that.
Susan, I want to hear your answer to this, but we actually just got word that your brother David is also on the line.
Oh,
so let me let David get a word in, and then we'll go back to you, Susan. David, welcome to City Visions.
First of all, thank you for helping me get a word in. I appreciate that.
I'm not sure I can help you with that off the air, but I'm happy to do it while we're on the air here. David, your mom talked about perhaps overstepping bounds at some points. Do you have any memories of that in your youth?
Sure. Yes. I mean, I think that the overstepping bounds had to do with just giving us a little bit too much information. I, for example, I didn't need to know about death squads in El Salvador when I'm 9 years old. That's not something that that's something where I understood how it's important to have a world view and your kids know what's going on in this world, including atrocities being done in our name. That's too much to lay on a kid at that age, you know, and I think that's something that I'm trying to do differently with my kids. Talk more about big ideas, general ideas, and share with them. Talk in a way, I think, that's more developmentally appropriate from what for where they're at and what how they're dealing with stuff.
Mm-hmm. Susan, would you like to weigh in?
Yeah, I would concur about that. You know, I think, you know, that's the place that I went to, too, about, you know, both of my parents were very active in talking about Central America, what was happening in El Salvador and Nicaragua. But I think that there is, that both David and I now really think carefully about how much of the details to share. And it's a process, you know, a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more rather than being in. And I don't even think they always knew. I think that was part of the problem. Like, we might have come into the room without them knowing and then hearing things that would probably, you know, at a meeting or at a protest, that there could have been a little more of, you know, a protection from what we heard. I mean, I think one of the things that I really valued is knowing the full political histories of all these countries and the U.S. role, and as my brother was saying, the bigger ideas. But the details of torture and things probably would have been better to not have us here as kids.
So with your own children, Susan and David, how are you able to pass through the values that your parents taught you while also perhaps protecting them from some of the, you know, harsh realities of the world at a young age?
Well, I think, you know, finding that balance, it's not a, you know, one thing you appreciate when you become a parent yourself is that the whole thing is a process, and sometimes you might get it more right than others. You know, recently my son asked me if he could join me on a trip. I've been involved in doing support work for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida and their campaign for fair food with the tomatoes in Southwest Florida. And they've really involved clergy people very well. And I've worked for several years with them and had an opportunity to come to Florida. And my son actually asked to come. And I remember going, wow, okay, that's great that he's asking. He's going to miss some school. And there it was, Grandma Ruth stepping in and going, you know, he's going to learn a lot more than he would, you know, he's going to miss a couple days of school, but think of what he's going to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great grandmother voice right there. And so he did come with me. And, you know, a lot of what we learned about, which I didn't know the full extent to which there had been slavery, modern-day slavery in the tomato fields, imprisoning primarily immigrant workers, but also other workers, against their will in trucks and in different encampments. And we had a chance to learn about that. And part of it for me was also just watching his body language and hearing a little bit and then suggesting to him, maybe let's go for a walk outside, you know, needing to trust the instinct when it felt like it was too much. Whereas I think as a kid, we probably would have stayed for the whole talk kind of thing, you know, that balancing.
Yeah. What about you, David, with the balancing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also about just making sure to leave some energy for home.
Mm-hmm.
And really make sure that the kids are connected to the broader kind of struggles that all of us have going on. And for me, it's a lot about unions and teacher unions. That's where my emphasis on is with them and my work, my life's work. But it's also about really... making sure to be there at basketball practice, you know, making sure to value all that stuff and not miss practices to be at meetings all the time as well. It's really setting limits as well. So it's part of where we take people,
in.
But it's also probably
I agree. I think that I don't think we ever talked directly about the torture, but still, I think I'm getting good feedback about this, but one thing we did do, I coached my kids and all of the, Susie played football up until middle school. All of my kids, all the kids, four kids, so it wasn't just being political.
That's true.
We active in our community including their athletic and other activities. So I think it does have to be a balance, and I don't want you to think the only thing they did is go to demonstrations, because we had big community parties, and David certainly, and Susie became a modern dancer, and I went to her performances at the Performing Arts School, and David played on one of the best basketball teams in L.A., had NBA stars on it, and he went on to play in Europe basketball. So it's a balance, but I just wanted to emphasize that I think that lots of my friends, for whatever reason, once they had children, didn't engage them in their life and their values as an activist. And I think that's absolutely crucial, as well as having a well-balanced life with their other activities.
Art, let me follow up and ask you. You were raising your children in a very unique time in the history of our country. What is it like passing your values on to your grandchildren now? How is it similar and different to when you were passing it on to your children in a very different era?
Well, one thing, they really grew up in the 80s, too, in the early 90s, so it wasn't that activist then. I think it was...
I see. Your activist past was pre... This was much later than your times at Berkeley.
Yeah. I mean, they were born in the 70s, but really grew up in the 80s, in a way. And there were still some things going on. They were very active in what... And we're the leadership of the Student Coalition. And I was kind of the parent advisor. And every year, on Martin Luther King's birthday, literally hundreds of high school and middle school kids took over the South African consulate. So you had to sort of create your activity, but it is different, and it's certainly different for my grandkids, where I think that the period we're currently in, if they didn't have such strong parents with such good activist values and who are active, it would be much more difficult for these kids today in such a cynical, upset, topsy-turvy world to have hope. And the thing that I tried to pass on, and their mother certainly did too, is to have hope that you can really, the free speech movement taught me that we came from nowhere. Literally, in the early 60s was like the 50s, but we stuck together and had great comradeship and fought, and we saw that we could change the world. We started a student movement throughout the world. So from that moment on, I never lost hope, and I think they give that to their kids, too. So hopefully their grandkids will be the next activist generation.
And Ruth, what about you? What is similar and what is different about passing your values on to your grandchildren today versus your children when you were raising them?
Well, I think there's one. I think we're talking about one definition of activism here, which is sort of out in the streets and going to demonstrations. I think the thing that I really value is sort of the activism on the relationship level, children really learning about empathy and compassion. And I think, we did a really good job with that with our children. And I think my children have the benefit of sort of having a children who were grew up at that time, their own sub-community. And I really value that sort of home relationship, good value teaching, which I think translates as they grow up into sort of anti-bias and anti-violent work. So I think, that's very similar going on now, that was a real, it wasn't just activism in the streets, I'm trying to say. It was really, we really cared about how we treated each other and how we valued each other. And I see my grandchildren really being, those values being really strongly passed on to them. So I think that's similar, And I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of my children around what's appropriate and what's not appropriate out in that world out there. And I think that we were very much caught up in the moment and didn't have enough of that reflective practice. So, Yeah. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk to this terrific family. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing growing up on the picket line with my guests, Rabbi Susan Goldberg of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple, her brother David Goldberg of the California Teachers Association, and her parents, Art Goldberg, former free speech movement organizer and attorney, and Ruth Beaglehole, educator and founder of Echo Parenting and Education. Are you part of a movement family? Did you grow up on the picket line and now run the other way? What's your story? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on the KALW website. Susan and David, let me go back to you. Did you have a sense as kids that your family was different in some ways than others based on the background of your parents? Or were there other kids in the neighborhood who were coming from a similar situation?
Well, I think both. I mean, there were kids who we were, you know, growing up around whose families were also political and were all sort of intentionally living around each other. And there were also other times, though, where it was abundantly clear that we were different. I mean, one of the clear, we lived down the street from Dodger Stadium. And so we would go to the Dodger games a lot, and I always remember getting, you know, wishing we often would be late because we were walking, and I would wish that we would get there after the national anthem, because my dad had a thing about not wanting us to stand for the national anthem, and we would certainly hear about that from the other fans. So those were times where I was like, right, we are outside of the mainstream here in this family.
David?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would concur with Susie. There was always times, you know, and there was times, I think, as a kid where that could be awkward and like any, you know, anything you go through. The other thing, though, I should say about both my parents is that both of them really came to politics out of love. The way they do politics is really It's really an infectious way of doing it. They weren't grumpy activists. And so actually, as people would meet my parents or get to know my parents, they were actually some of the most, you know, well-liked parents in the neighborhood, in any neighborhood I was in. And partly because of the way they directly connected to the way they saw the world as a place where you take care of people and it wasn't disconnected from their activists. So I think it went both ways, but there's always that there. It's always hard to be different, but I think on the whole, it actually was a plus on the whole.
And so, Art and Ruth, it sounds like you were able to be fun parents, while at the same time teaching your kids about a lot of the troubles in the world. How did you strike that balance between being showing the love and kindness and joy, but also really fighting these really difficult battles?
Well, that's really nice to hear my children say that. Because I think, you know, actually, you know, my children went through a pretty hard divorce, you know, between Art and I, and you know, there was a lot of stress and a lot of tension and a lot of community divisiveness about what happened at that time. And yet I think what held on was a real sense of love, you know, for these children, that the community loved these children. These children had multiple adults in their life, and when things were really hard between Art and I, and things were really hard for many years, I think that was a community behind them that really balanced that. So, you know, I have regrets that I actually didn't have more joy and, you know, wasn't able to feel more joy at that time that I found so stressful in my, you know, when my children were little. And then the fact that one of our children was born deaf And there was a lot of stress around communication and sign language. So I'm touched to hear that they felt that, because I have a lot of regrets around how hard that all was. On the other hand, was buoyed by a lovely and wonderful intentional community.
Yeah,
Art?
I think the thing that is the most unique was the community we had, a large enough group of friends in Echo Park area where people migrated in the early 70s. This community's been through many changes. Now it's being gentrified, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, and I think the other adult people really did help us. It was a terrible, painful breakup. The community took often sides on it. And so I don't want to romanticize how groovy life always was. So we went through really hard times, but somehow we got through it. And I think that we, for the most part, not always, for the most part, both of us tried to constantly do what was right for the kids. We never had any court orders, but we had informal shared custody the whole way, and that meant that the kids, in the end, despite all the bitterness, would come out on top.
Okay, let us go to a caller now. We have Kareem on the line from Oakland. Kareem, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you so much. I just had kind of an interesting perspective. I would consider myself, a child of activist parents, or I had a father who's, an academic anthropologist, a bit of a democratic socialist, Marxist. But I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, where we really stuck out like a sore thumb. Mm. I always kind of wished that we were in Berkeley or New York or, it really made us really different. And I would say, kind of reflecting on some of what you're saying, the quality of levity was really kind of missing. And I think it really, in some ways, damaged my relationship with my father. But, there was kind of funny, odd moments. I remember the not being able to stand up during the national anthem and people kind of looking at us a little odd. Or, my father still kind of counts, with pride, my sister running to him because we were having a childhood squabble and, she was in tears saying, he called me a capitalist. that was like the worst thing you could be. It's kind of that weird teenage period where we weren't really connecting and, my parents were divorcing. For a while, my attempt to connect with him was usually going to a protest or demonstration somewhere, and he would normally take over and start speaking because he was kind of known as an academic. But, the interesting thing is, I kind of, for several years, my activism was kind of in the background. Now I run the public programs at CIIS in San Francisco. And, I've really made a point to, feature programs that look at race and class and gender and, LGBT issues. And, we were hosting Cornell West a few years ago, and I was kind of boning up for the event, and so I was reading Race Matters. And I was sitting there going, God, this sounds like my dad. And what I realized was, as much as, my conflictual relationship with my father that I think was, rooted in his activism and some of, his kind of one-pointedness, he gave me a grounding that really affects how I move through the world, how I look at, foreign national issues, foreign issues, and how I kind of live in my community. So, we're still not very close. He moved off to Australia to get out of this country. And, I'm really grateful for, it's kind of funny because I'm entrepreneurial by nature. And I was joking with a friend the other day that I think I'll be a lot more successful in this tech SF world that we live in if he hadn't kind of ingrained these important characteristics of equity and equality, and I think I would make another $100,000 a year if I wasn't kind of thinking about, if I didn't feel like I was compromising my values by working in a corporate setting.
Kareem, thank you so much for your comments. We really appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're going to have to let this family go in a moment, but just wanted to see if any of you have a quick response to Kareem's comments.
Well, I appreciate his sharing about the isolation and living in other cities where it wasn't as, you know, it wasn't, there weren't enough other people to have more community support. And I think you heard that when both my mom and my dad were sharing that they really didn't do this alone, that they we really were raised as a part of a community. And that was so helpful on so many aspects. Certainly, you know, you can think of how it allowed us to integrate our values, but it was also, as my mom shared, just so important for all of our lives that we had so many people around us caring and committing to raising kids in this community.
Okay, well, we are out of time with this group. Susan, David, Art, and Ruth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Good night.
We are now going to move on to part two of our program, where we're going to be talking to three activists who are also parents and mentors about how they pass their values down to their children and to the folks that they are mentoring. We are joined now by Mateo Noob. Since moving to the Bay Area, Bolivia-born Mateo has worked in the labor, environmental justice, and international solidarity movements. He's a co-founder of the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project and an educator who has designed and conducted trainings and workshops for organizations interested in growing their organizing, advocacy, and leadership capacities. He's the father of Maya and Nilo and a member of the Latin rock band Los Nadies, and he'll be joining us momentarily. We also have on the phone Joel B. Tan. Joel is an award-winning writer, performer, and international trailblazer in connecting arts with social justice, public health, and community development. He has published 3 volumes of poetry and edited 3 fiction anthologies and other writing on race, power, and identity. He is currently the director of community engagement at the Yerba Buena Center of the Arts and previously co-founded LA's Asian Pacific AIDS Intervention Team Health Center. Joel, welcome to the program.
Hello. Good evening.
We are also joined by Michelle Mascarenhas Swan. She's a collective member of Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project. She co-chairs the National Climate Justice Alliance and Our Power campaign, which recently helped turn out record numbers of people from communities on the front lines of the climate and economic crisis at the recent People's Climate March in New York. She is the mother of 2 children, and she will be joining us momentarily. Mateo is now on the line, I understand. Mateo, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. An honor to be here.
Okay, while we wait for Michelle to get on, let me get started. And Mateo, let me go with you first. You grew up in Bolivia under a dictatorship. How did that influence you as a kid, and how does it influence you today as a parent?
Well, thank you for asking. It's an important question. Just the reality of living in a situation where injustice was in evidence all around us every day made kind of, made us as kids become adults rather quickly and made us realize the difference between what is just and what is wrong in very stark terms. So even though under a dictatorship we can actually talk about a lot of things up front, it was clear what needed to change, and thankfully the adults around me were all folks who really were committed to changing what was unjust in our country, and that really formed my understanding of the world, watching the adults around me really struggle for a change that brought both democracy and equity and justice into everybody's lives.
And can you tell us more about the work you're doing today?
Sure. As you mentioned earlier, both Michelle, who will be on the show, and myself are part of an organization called Movement Generation, and we work with a range of different grassroots organizations in the Bay Area and now nationally as well to really bring together the struggles for social and racial justice with the struggles for the defense of our planet, very much knowing that climate change and many other ills that are taking place on a planetary level are rooted in the same causes of so many other injustices, meaning we have an economic system that is mismanaging home in our neighborhoods and at a planetary level, and we need to move from a me economy to a we economy that really takes care of people and planet at the same place. So we at Movement Generation are really focused on building our social movement muscles to make that happen.
Michelle, I understand you're on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes. Hi.
And could you start by talking about your work today?
Yeah. So like Mateo said, we work together at Movement Generation. We're both part of a collective in that organization. And, so my work is supporting the build-out of a national movement that can really stand for a new economy that benefits people and the planet that we all depend on. And so, we've launched this national campaign called Our Power, which is really, it's national, but really we understand that the remaking of economy is at the root of what needs to change in order to address the climate crisis. And that has to happen in our homes, in our neighborhoods, you know, where we live, work, play, and pray, as the environmental justice movements have taught us, you know. And so, so we're about really relearning how to manage home. You know, many of us, all of us here at Movement Generation are, you know, most of us in this on this land are displaced peoples, and it's our task to first of all take the leadership and learnings of Indigenous peoples from this land, whose land they have been stewarding for so long, but to then understand what our project is, which is really about right relationship to place. So as parents, actually, you know, most of us at Movement Generation are parents. And so it's interesting listening to, you know, the family, the Goldberg family that was on just a little while ago, because I think, you know, what David Goldberg said about parents talking to their kids about these huge, you know, mind-boggling crises of our times is really real and resonant for all of us here. You know, what could be bigger than the disruption of the life support systems of the planet that we all depend on and that is killing and, you know, and harming and pushing people out of their homes on a constant basis, as is the economy that's responsible for that and the empire that's responsible for that crisis. And yet, I think one of the things that we really strive for and have been able to embody is to bring a sense of resilience to that project, that it's actually, we can be up to that task, and it's actually going to be, it's going to be hard, but it's going to be beautiful if we can do it in a way that is about remaking our relationships to each other and to ourselves and to place.
Thanks for that, Michelle. Joelle, let me now turn to you. Tell us about your work, and then I want to ask all three of you about the next generation. But to set the foundation here, Joelle, tell us about the work you're involved in today.
Well, in terms of my own personal work, I feel like my personal mission is to be in this world to make change, and I do that as an artist. And in terms of the work that I've done and that I do, I spent 16 years working in public health where, I co-founded Asian Pacific AIDS Intervention Team in Los Angeles, and so much of that work came out of, a real passion, a calling for what was happening at the time, which was this incredible pandemic, this plague war. And I was called to that, I think, largely because I came up in a family. It all so much begins with the personal. Similar right. to my other panelists, I came from a family. I was born in Manila in 1968, spent the first 8 years of my life in martial law in a family that was very left and very active and very anti-dictatorship. So from the moment I was born, I was already put in a situation where right and wrong was talked about, what activism and resistance was about. And I think more importantly, to grow up in an environment knowing that whatever is happening now and all of the ways that it is unjust and unfit, it's important to actively imagine what's next. So to that, I think I took that experience of both trauma and empowerment, and when we came to the United States, and it was largely because of martial law and my mother's anti-dictator activities that got us to the United States, it wasn't a surprise in looking back that I was very active in AIDS work and in the direct action years of HIV. So in that process, I like a whole generation, a couple of generations of artists created what I always think of as the largest social practice project in our lifetime, which was AIDS work. Mm-hmm. And from there, I spent 16 or 17 years doing what I know to do best as an artist in terms of creating the kinds of primarily education programs that would resonate with many different kinds of people, including newly arrived immigrants, Asian Americans, people of color. It just really gave me a foundation in terms of the work that I continue to do, which is to engage communities. So a lot of those early years of AIDS work were really important in terms of developing youth programs and care programs that I think have basically changed public health and social justice forever. So it was that kind of effort.
Thank you, Joelle. Let's take a quick short station break here. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing growing up on the picket line with my guests, Mateo Noob, co-founder of the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project, Michelle Mascarenhas-Swan of Movement Generation and co-chair of National Climate Justice Alliance, and Joelle Beaton, longtime artist and changemaker. Okay, the number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Are you part of a movement family? Did you grow up on the picket line and now run the other way? You can call us or email or text us at cityvision@klw.org or go to our website. You can also, again, call us. The number, again, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Mateo, let me turn back to you. Your mother was a Holocaust survivor. How did that inform your organizing approach?
Yes. My mother, I think one of the many things she gleaned out of that tremendous experience was a very clear interpretation of what never again means, which some folks may know is a statement that is common amongst Jews. And for her, never again meant never again towards anybody. And, you know, she came from a family that really interpreted that part of our responsibility in the world is to ensure that everybody live a life that was full of dignity and that everybody's needs be met. And I think that is one of the great contributions that she's made to my life and to everybody in our family's life, is that, you know, she migrated to South America as a child in 1945 and went on to teach us that whether it was witnessing racism, whether it was witnessing tremendous economic injustice, that we had a responsibility, given our heritage, to really be part of collective action and collective thinking and collective caretaking, such that we, with others, built a society where caring and sharing were foundational to how we organized ourselves. And
and how are you passing that along to your own children?
Well, one of the things that really struck me in the conversation that happened between the Goldbergs was when I think it was David reflecting on how his parents really practiced their activism and their politics through a lens of love. And I think that is actually very, very real, that folks that have inspired me the most in my and people who've mentored me are folks who have really practiced their activism and their organizing through a very loving, fun, compassionate, even when they're being bold and militant in a direct way. And I've really tried to teach my kids and the kids around me that same practice, whether it's about individual interactions with other human beings, or whether it's us showing up in bigger spaces, that whether it's the way you look at somebody, the way you talk to somebody, the way you touch somebody, that really believing that we can and want to and should really care for each other and show up in our full self. You know, it's almost a spiritual transcendent practice to political organizing in some ways. That's I try to show up in my kids' life in that way. And very much, again, it was very generative to hear the Goldbergs talking about how much or how little do you share with your kids. And, you know, those of us who have the privilege to shelter our kids may choose to do that, and some of us don't because we're living very harsh realities. But I think what I got out of that exchange is that in the midst of whether it's privilege or tremendous hardship and struggle, the way we hold each other, the way we show up for each other, the way we pick up ourselves again after experiencing something really painful really matters. And I think that way of recommitting to a loving posture towards community, towards our neighborhood, towards our friends, towards our planet is I think one of the foundational ways that I try to behave around my kids and my kids' friends, even when we're talking about such tremendous challenges like taking down empire.
Okay, let's take a final station break and then return to our conversation. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. You can join our conversation about growing up on the picket line by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website. Michelle, let me go to you next. How do you take the values that you bring to work every day and pass those on to your children?
Yeah, well, yeah, it was really beautiful what Mateo just shared, and I think that is very much what I strive to do. So one of the things that I've been a part of is helping to build a whole set of, like, different cooperatives of parents and families that are about really taking care of each other. So we have after-school co-ops where we're, you know, the kids go to a different family's house every day, and there's nine or ten kids, you know, that go together, they do their homework together, they look out for each other during the day.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Michelle. I think one of our guests has the radio on in the background. If I could just ask you to turn it down because it's interfering a little bit with what Michelle is saying, we'd really appreciate it. And with that, Michelle, please continue.
Sure. So I think it's about teaching them, and not just teaching, but really through setting up infrastructure for them through community structures that really enable us to hold each other. You know, we're both showing that's important by valuing it and putting our own time into that, so that, you know, if somebody has to work late, there's always somebody to look after your kids, and it's not a chore, it's a labor of love. You know, we all love hanging out with each other's families. We cook together, we eat together, you know, and this isn't like every night all the time, but we have each other's backs, you know, when someone's having trouble in their marriage, similar to what the Goldbergs were talking about. You know, we're there for each other, and it's important that the kids embody that kind of love, caring reality check on, you know, what can really happen, but that we can get through it, you know, that we have each other. If we know how to take care of each other, we can get through it. And I think one of the things that's so critical to me about that is that the project of our time is not anymore about incremental steps. know, we can't just win the fight for a new contract. We can't just win, you know, a reform law to stop the power plant from polluting quite as much as it has. No, we have to actually radically remake economy. And that's a huge task. And the, you know, the work that we're doing, these little steps of, you know, setting up co-ops or doing these things to take care of each other, that's definitely not going to topple the empire. But what I seek to do is to create a way of being in the world that allows us as a family to be willing and able to take bolder, more directly oppositional and visionary action that's going to actually change the story. So not just my family, but for you know, lots and lots of people, beginning to set up these kinds of infrastructures and embody a way of moving in the world and believing that we can actually take action that's going to make a significant change, I think is really crucial.
Joelle, let me turn to you next, and I'd like to ask you about the kind of mentors you had or didn't have, given the missing generation that you referred to earlier, and then to talk about the mentoring that you do today with young people.
Okay. In terms of the, when I think of mentors, and particularly the work around HIV/AIDS, I would say there was some mentorship, but because it was all happening to us at the same time, I believe we mentored each other. And really, through that really epic time, imparted values, skills to each other, and really worked together to create the movement we now know as AIDS work, and all that's resulted from it. And I think what's so I think of friends, of fallen friends, Corey Roberts Ali. I think of Ferd Egan. I think of lots of different folks who are no longer here, and the impact, and really what the impact of that lost generation is about. So to that end, in some ways, I personally maybe I do a little bit of compensation or catch up, because I often think of what would it have been like in 2014 to have had these brilliant minds and these passionate souls dealing with the world now, and what kind of change making would even be possible now with these people that were amazing, brilliant, revolutionary. And so to that, I feel like what I'm left with is in some ways a sense of wanting to carry that forward, wanting to carry forward their stories and their passions. And one way of doing that is to mentor a new generation. And in the ways that I can, through the work of YBCA, the work I do as a sister, the work that I do just as a human on this planet, is to be conscious. Well, one, I can help create programs. We have, and I've been in my history, have created a number of youth programs. But in terms of the mentorship, one normally thinks to youth, and I think that's important, and there's some of that work. But I also think about one major impact of the lost generation is what's happening with our seniors and what's happening with us, particularly in the queer communities. I see aging queer Gen Xers and baby boomers. More often than not, I feel the impact of that lost generation when I see how vulnerable we are as we get older and in this current economy. So all the more reason so that when, you know, working with those older folks, my peers and youth, I feel like the current agenda is about working cross-sector, is about working with urban planning, with community development, social justice, economics, to and artists to achieve a greater end. The very coordination of all these things become the art itself for change making. So that's kind of what I think about. I'm actually wondering what's possible across sectors and what we can do in 2014 moving forward.
Well, that's a great segue moving forward as we're almost out of time here. Mateo Nube, let me go back to you to finish us off here. And just can you just leave us as a parent, as an activist, with some words of wisdom for parents out there or for other adults who are mentoring young people? What advice would you have in terms of passing values down to the next generation?
I think I want to return to something Michelle said, which I think really hits at home, is we are living at an epic moment in the history of our species, that the choices we make collectively are going to determine whether the future of the planet as it is going to be one that really roots itself in sharing and taking care of each other and navigating this transition that's already happening well, or whether we're going to give ourselves up to this dominant culture of competition and exploitation. So I think we have this dual responsibility on an individual level to really share with our kids values that are rooted in believing in the better side of ourselves as a species, and at the same time really teaching our kids what is that muscle that we need to build up that is so lacking in our culture here, at least dominant culture, which is of acting together in the midst of difficulty and really rising to the occasion of caring for each other in the good times and the hard times. And I think...
Thank you, Mateo. Unfortunately, I really appreciate that, but I want to make sure to let Michelle and Joelle get a final word in here. Michelle, unfortunately, we only have about 30 seconds, but could you kind of crystallize what values you think parents should be passing on?
Sure. I'll just add to what Mateo said, which is to say that abundance versus scarcity.
Yes.
That actually, and we found this at MG, like we work so hard, but it's almost like every bit that we do is magnified tenfold because we are so inspired and like generated by each other, actually, because we have love for each other. You know, we look after each other, and this is true everywhere that we go as humans. We find that out. It's like when you give of yourself, you get a lot back. And I think this is the lesson. This is the moment in which we have to be teaching our children that, because as we think that things are scarcer and scarcer, we get scared and fearful, and we act from that place instead of a place of love and being the big free souls and spirits that we are all capable of being, and that's how we have to show up in this moment.
Thank you, Michelle. Joelle, a very quick last word from you.
I would just say I hope we all continue to work across sectors, and particularly for marginalized people, for us to perpetually imagine a better future for ourselves continuously.
Thank you, Joelle, Michelle, Mateo. We really appreciate you being with us. My guests earlier in the program were Susan Goldberg, Art Goldberg, David Goldberg, and Ruth Beagleholder. That's City Visions for this evening. We appreciate everyone for joining us. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Bob Sommer. Tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. City Visions is off this week, but do tune in to KOLW next Monday to hear a debate between State Assembly candidates David Campos and David Chu. Please join us the following Monday, October 20th, as we discuss San Francisco's Proposition G, the real estate transfer tax, on the November ballot. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.